You're listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is Graham Hancock. Graham Hancock is the author of The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Supernatural, and other best-selling investigations of historical mysteries. He specializes in groundbreaking theories involving ancient civilizations and myths, megaliths, consciousness, and astronomical and astrological data from the past. His lectures and broadcasts, including two major TV series, Quest for the Lost Civilization and Flooded Kingdoms of the Ice Age, have further established his reputation as an unconventional thinker who raises controversial questions about humanity's past. Written with the same page-turning appeal that has made his nonfiction so popular, the fantasy adventure novel Entangled is his first work of fiction. He is a featured presenter at the annual Ancient Mysteries Conference, Digging for the Truth, at the ARE in Virginia Beach from October 4th to the 7th.
Thank you for coming on the show today.
That's my pleasure. Very good to be with you.
Well, now, I wanted to say that I've been interested in your work since I was in high school and you published The Sign and the Seal. I wanted to travel to Ethiopia myself at the time, and I wanted to sneak into that chapel that might contain the Ark. What inspired you to write that book?
Well, you know, like many things in my life, it was a series of accidents, although one might call them synchronicities today. I was a reporter. I was very much a mainstream reporter, the East Africa correspondent for The Economist, you know, a serious business and political and news magazine. And I was covering East Africa and covering the problems and turmoils of East Africa, the wars, the famines, the conflicts of that region. And Ethiopia, I was based in Nairobi in Kenya, but Ethiopia was a country that I regularly visited that was on my beat. And I just came across this claim that the Ethiopians make to possess the lost Ark of the Covenant. In fact, I was flown in on a troop carrier aircraft into the city of Aksum in the north of Ethiopia, which at that time was under siege, where there is this ancient Christian cathedral called the Cathedral of St. Mary of Zion, and in its grounds a little chapel surrounded by metal railings. And inside the chapel, a monk who told me through the translator that he was the guardian of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, this was in the early 1980s, and as a matter of fact, just a year or so before I had this bizarre encounter in the highlands of Ethiopia, I had seen, as so many of us have, the Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark. So I knew what the Ark of the Covenant was, and suddenly here's this monk, very powerful in a way, with cataracts in his eyes, telling me that he has the Ark of the Covenant in this building behind him and that he is its guardian, and that since he was appointed as its guardian, he is never again allowed to leave the grounds of this little chapel. And I was intrigued. I was fascinated. I was puzzled. I mean, could this possibly be true, or was it just some outlandish claim? And I started to look into it and investigate it. And I found that although scholars were dismissive, there was a great deal that helped to support the Ethiopian claim and began to add credibility to it. For example, the fact that no other country in the world has a living tradition of veneration of the Ark of the Covenant. Ethiopia does. The Ark of the Covenant is not a Christian relic. It's a pre-Christian relic, but it's been incorporated into Ethiopian Christianity. There are 20,000 churches in Ethiopia. Every one of them has a replica of the Ark of the Covenant in its Holy of Holies, all of which are said to draw their power from the original Ark that is kept in this sanctuary chapel in the city of Aksum in northern Ethiopia. Then there's the issue of the Falashas, the so-called the Beta Israel, the black Jews of Ethiopia, who practice an Old Testament form of Judaism. How had they got to Ethiopia? What was their story? So I began to investigate this initially as a reporter, and I found myself drawn into an immense and intriguing historical mystery and into the real possibility that this remote country in the highlands of Africa did in fact possess the most precious, the most extraordinary, the most powerful relic of Old Testament times. and that it perhaps had not arrived there in the ways that the Ethiopians themselves believed, but that there might be an underlying historical story that made sense of the whole thing. And this drew me out of current affairs and news and all of the subjects that I'd been covering for years as a journalist, and drew me into historical mystery, hopefully applying the same skills, the same rigorous techniques, the same investigative approach, but exploring a subject that I would never previously have considered exploring as a journalist. And it changed my life. I completely changed the direction of my life after this, and the experiences that I had, the wonderful experiences. I feel I've been blessed to have the opportunities I've had to travel in remote and far-off places and have amazing adventures and confrontations and confront mystery and get to grips with it.
At the time, you went from a very serious journalistic career to something that some people might consider fringe.
Yes.
How did you interact with your colleagues when that happened? What was the response?
I just cut myself off from the world of journalism. It just stopped being what I did, and I became a researcher and a writer of books. There was no. One thing amongst journalists that's understood is a good story is a good story. And what I was pursuing here was, whatever else it was a good story. It was a fascinating and intriguing mystery that deserved to be followed. So nobody put me down because of that. And I think the fact that I was an experienced journalist, that I had a track record behind me as a reporter for major newspapers and magazines, helped me to be taken more seriously when I did present the data I had on the sign and the, in my book The Sign and the Seal, and indeed in subsequent books like Fingerprints of the Gods. Perhaps the subjects had previously been monopolized by the fringe, but here was somebody with a very serious approach, taking a serious and detailed look at it, and doing so in books that were thoroughly researched and supported by evidence and data, and with the sources fully cited, you know, so that people can see where I'm getting my information from.
So it's a very useful background to have when you're dealing with these, some people might consider fringe, but in the future it could be something that becomes well established.
Well, see, I think that there is a need and a role in our society for those who are prepared to question conventional wisdom. We are much too dependent on so-called experts and so-called authority figures in particular fields. And we tend to get locked into a particular mindset and a particular way of looking at things. And this is especially true of history, where historians and archaeologists claim to be the sole arbiters of our knowledge about the past, and don't really let us understand that what they are telling us is also a story. It is an interpretation of the facts. And the further back you go in the past, the thinner and thinner the facts become. What I've come to understand is that historians and archaeologists really should not have this monopoly on the past. And this monopoly is very strong. It's manifested through the mass media. It's manifested through the education system. Our view of the past as being something cut and dried and sorted out that our experts fully understand is almost taken in with our mother's milk. But there is a viable alternative point of view. And I feel that it's right and proper that this alternative point of view should be put to the public, and that the public should have the right to make up their minds, not just on the basis of one set of facts and interpretations, those presented by the mainstream, but on the basis of thoroughly researched facts and interpretations by people who take a different view of the past. I don't actually claim that I'm 100% right in everything that I say. I'm not a fanatic. I don't insist that I have myself a monopoly on the truth. What I'm trying to do is restore the balance to a deeply unbalanced situation where one particular mindset and one body of opinion has dominated the public view of the past and not allowed us to consider the possibility of such things as lost civilizations, for example, which has been a major focus of mine for many, many years.
Could you tell us about your research regarding the Giza Plateau?
Giza Plateau really has come to play a very important role in my life. And this role began in 1989, while I was researching my first investigation of a historical mystery, which was The Sign and the Seal, the book about the Ark of the Covenant. It's really impossible to explore the mystery of the Ark of the Covenant without coming across the figure of Moses. Because it's Moses who leads the children of Israel towards the Promised Land and through Sinai, where the Ark of the Covenant is supposedly built according to a divine blueprint. And Moses, of course, as we all know, following the biblical story, at any rate, was raised in the household of the Pharaoh and groomed as a future Pharaoh of Egypt.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Graham Hancock.
You can't get to grips with the story of Moses without going to Egypt, and it was while following my research into Moses for the Ark of the Covenant that I first went to Egypt and first found myself on the Giza Plateau, standing in front of the Great Pyramid of Egypt, the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, this extraordinary 481-foot high, 6 million ton, I mean perfectly built, perfectly aligned to true north, south, east, and west, stunningly beautiful, majestic, powerful, just standing there on this enormous desert plateau, and I'm looking up at this incredible creation, and I'm thinking, how did they do that? What is the story of this? It seemed to beckon to me. It seemed to call to me. What is the story of this extraordinary structure? Why does it have this amazing magnetic appeal that draws people from all around the world, not just today, but for thousands of years have been drawn to the Great Pyramid? And it captivated me. It almost cast a spell over me. And even though I was researching the book on the Ark of the Covenant, right there, right then, I knew that I needed to do a whole lot more work on the pyramids and to understand as best as I could what was going on with the pyramids. And when I started to do that, I quickly found that once again, I was up against an academic lobby with a very rigid and narrow framework and point of view who insisted, despite the fact that there is really no evidence for this whatsoever, that the Great Pyramids of Giza are tombs and tombs only for three named pharaohs of the fourth dynasty. There is really stunningly little evidence for that proposition, but that proposition is what is taught to us in schools and taught to us through the mass media. And the insistence that these gigantic blocks of stone were raised up into the pyramids by gangs of men towing the stones on ropes, and a very simple scenario is presented for all of this, and we're almost expected just to accept that. But when you actually get to grips with the pyramid, when you climb the Great Pyramid five times, as I have done, from bottom to top, when you explore every one of its inner passageways, when you visit every one of its chambers, some of which are permanently closed to the public, for example, the relieving chambers above the king's chamber, then you gradually begin to realize that this is a very deeply mysterious place, and that the conventional story that is being told about it doesn't do justice to its magic and its mystery at all. So I've been privileged to make, I can't even begin to count the number of visits that I've made to Giza, and the enormous amount of time that I've spent there in every season, and the exploration, and the gradual coming to understand the power and wonder of this place. Things that you don't notice at first. Yes, it's huge. Yes, it's stunning to the eye. But you know, to discover that it is aligned to true north, south, east, and west within just 3/60ths of a single degree. That makes you think once you know that. That's not just building on a giant scale, but that is building with very, very, very high precision. And there must be a very powerful motive behind that to get that done, to discover that the Great Pyramid is mathematically a scale model of one hemisphere of the Earth. And to be told by Egyptologists that this is just a coincidence, I mean, they recognize the numbers, but they say it's a coincidence. To me, that's just beggars belief. I mean, I'll give you the details very briefly,
which is
that if you take the height of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by a very specific number, which is 43,200, you get the polar radius of the Earth. And if you take the base perimeter of the Great Pyramid and multiply it by the same number, 43,200, you get the equatorial circumference of the Earth. The dimensions of the Earth are coded into the geometry and the physical measurements of the Great Pyramid of Egypt. In all those centuries and thousands of years, the so-called Dark Ages, when people didn't even know that the Earth was round or what its dimensions were, all they ever needed to do was go to Giza and measure the Great Pyramid and multiply by 43,200, and they had the exact key dimensions of our planet. And this in a monument that is at least 4,500 years old, quite possibly much, much, much older than that. And the number that the pyramid is scaled to, this 43,200, is not just any old random number. It's a number that relates to an astronomical phenomenon called precession of the equinoxes, caused by a wobble on the axis of the Earth. The positions and the rising points of the stars in the sky change very, very slowly down the ages. And this change in the sky operates at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. And the number 72, if you multiply that by 600, you get 43,000. 200, the scale at which the Great Pyramid is built. Again, you know, the ancients are not supposed to have had knowledge of precession of the equinoxes at the time when the Great Pyramid was built, but the number system that is key to the precession of the equinoxes we find built in again and again to the measurements of the Giza Plateau. So something very mysterious is going on here. The place is an archive of knowledge about the past. I mean, everybody knows about the traditions of the Hall of Records, and perhaps indeed there is a hidden chamber. I happen to believe there is deep beneath the ground at Giza. But even without a hidden chamber, the monuments themselves contain so much information about our planet that they can be regarded as a permanent archive of key data. In themselves, a sort of three-dimensional Hall of Records.
Well, now, when it comes to precession, I understand you extrapolated backwards and connected it to one of the shafts in the Great Pyramid to try and determine.
Yeah, and let me be clear here with the work that I've done on the precession of the equinoxes and Giza. Could never have been done without the work of my close friend and colleague Robert Bovall, the author of the Orion Mystery. And Robert and I have indeed written a number of books together, including The Message of the Sphinx, which looks at the very much focuses on the Sphinx and the pyramids of Giza. So I want to pay tribute to Robert Bovall's incredibly important work in this field, and it's been my great privilege to work very closely with Robert. He's a construction engineer by training and a self-made astronomer of great skill and competence. And here's the thing, I mean, that we now have computer programs, one of the good things about the computer revolution, which incorporates all the data on the precession of the equinoxes so that should you so wish to do so, you can see how the sky would have appeared above any point on the Earth's surface at any time in the last 30,000 years. It's a tremendous research tool. So you can place yourself, you can virtually place yourself at Giza on your computer screen and you can wind back the skies and see exactly how the stars stood and what angle they were above the horizon, where they rose, where they set, everything about them as they appeared at any time you choose in the last 30,000 years. You can see how they appeared and where they were in 2500 BC, which is around the time that the pyramids are supposed to have been built, and you can go much, much further back than that as well. And working with Robert on this intriguing mystery of unfolding the ancient skies and seeing how they relate to Giza, we showed not only his fundamental insight that the three stars of the belt of Orion have a very similar pattern in the sky to the three great pyramids of Giza, but that also, if you look at the entire site, including the Sphinx and including the pyramids, if you look at the entire site, you find that the site is pointing to two very specific dates using the precession of the equinoxes. And one of those dates, interestingly, is around 2500 BC, when the pyramids are supposed to have been built, according to Orthodox Egyptology. And Robert's breakthrough research in this field showed that the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber, that the chambers of the pyramids have these very narrow shafts, about 8 inches high and 8 inches wide, cut into their walls, which tunnel up through the body of the pyramid and point to particular regions of the sky. And the southern, it just so happens that the southern shaft, and indeed all the shafts point at key stars, the southern shaft points at the star Sirius as it crosses the meridian. The meridian is the north-south line that divides the sky above your head in 2500 BC. But when you take the whole layout of the site, when you look at the exact pattern of the three pyramids of Giza on the ground, and when you look in particular at the Great Sphinx, you find that they're drawing our attention to another date. And that date is around 10,500 BC, 8,000 years earlier than the date that the pyramids are supposed to have been built, because the match between the Belt of Orion and the three pyramids becomes perfect at 10,500 BC at dawn on the spring equinox. And exactly at that moment, the Great Sphinx, which is oriented perfectly towards due east, is looking at the rising of its own celestial counterpart, the constellation of Leo, behind the sun in the sky. So here are two pointers, the Sphinx looking due east, looking at its image in the sky, the constellation of Leo, and the three great pyramids on the ground as you face south, looking at the constellation of Orion as it crosses the meridian with the pyramids in the pattern of the three stars of the belt. And not only that, but the Nile River also perfectly mirrors the position of the Milky Way at that moment.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with Graham Hancock.
Now, you know, we're not saying that the whoever created this extraordinary design on the ground actually put the Nile there, but the suggestion is that that site was chosen in part because the Nile was there in that particular configuration, and the Giza Plateau was there in that place where the pyramids could be built, and the whole diagram could be made as above, so below, bringing down the sky of 10,500 BC and building it on the ground at Giza, but then adding to the mystery by incorporating into the monuments narrow shafts pointing at the sky which speak to the date of 2500 BC. So for us, what this speaks of, what this says, is a tremendous continuity at that site, that this is a deeply ancient prehistoric site which goes back at least to 10,500 BC, but which continued to be used, continued to be part of a system of knowledge, continued to have a priesthood attached to it, who worked with it in 2500 BC. So there's 8,000 years of continuous record associated with these monuments. And, of course, they're still there today.
Another thing that's interesting is that if there's a connection between the Sphinx and Leo,
yeah,
and 10,500 BC, that means the oral or written tradition or the identification of those stars with Leo,
yeah,
has been passed down for thousands and thousands of years.
Yes, and of course this is completely contrary to the conventional wisdom of mainstream archaeologists, who will tell you that these constellations were only identified as such. The Leo, Taurus, and so on and so forth were only identified as such by the Babylonians and the Greeks. And really that we can't dare to take back the recognition of the constellations in those forms with those names earlier than about, oh, let's say 500 BC. Well, I think that's complete nonsense. And actually, you know, presented evidence for this in many books. There's evidence that even on the painted caves, for example, in the Hall of Bulls in Lascaux in France, 17,000 years ago, there is imagery that shows the Pleiades and the constellation of Taurus. And really, I think it takes an astonishing arrogance on the part of modern scholars to say that ancient civilizations were incapable of observing the stars that lie along the path of the sun and that rise with the sun at the equinoxes, which are the constellations of the zodiac. I actually think the knowledge of the zodiac and the application of particular characters to it is vastly ancient. And the Babylonians and the Greeks were just latecomers to that tradition and picked it up from much more ancient cultures. And mistakenly, our scholars have given the whole thing to them.
Perhaps in a way, the Romans would adopt things from the Greeks.
Yes, exactly. This has been going on. This has been going on forever. And all we have are the latecomers who've been given credit for work that was done thousands of years before them by others much older and much wiser than they.
What do you think of the correlation with 10,500 BC in the data you've observed and measured? What do you think about that correlation with Edgar Cayce's statements about the age of the pyramids?
Well, I think it's absolutely fascinating. First of all, that Edgar Cayce is drawing attention to a very similar period. And secondly, that he is speaking of a hall of records. And he's speaking of Giza as the legacy of a lost civilization. That somehow the survivors of Atlantis came here and were to do with this. And I actually think he's spot on. I think that's what Giza is all about. This is what I've argued in all my books, that what we're looking at here, and what the ancient Egyptians themselves said, that there was a time that they called Zeptepi, the time of the gods, when mysterious strangers, construed as gods, came to Egypt, and created the foundations, the basis of everything that Egypt was to become in future ages, and laid out on the ground the primeval mounds that were to be the foundation stones of all the great temples and pyramids of Egypt. And it's fascinating that Cayce, through his own methods and his own approach, touches on this. Of course, many scientists, most scientists, all scientists perhaps, would want to reject any notion of psychic channeling or any thought that genuine, valid information might be obtained by any other method than the scientific method. But to me, that's just yet another example of the arrogance and narrow-mindedness of science. You know, today, if we want to insult somebody, we call that person a dreamer. In modern society, you call somebody a dreamer, you're insulting them. But in ancient times, it was understood that dreaming was a valid method of knowledge, that it was a vital method of knowledge, that true knowledge came through dreams, and indeed through visions. And I think that it's a sign of the imaginative poverty of our society that we're unable to accept the power of intuition and the power of vision and the power of altered states of consciousness, of trance states, and my understanding is that Cayce did his readings in trance states, that in these states, which are outside the scientific method, that it may be possible to gain access to true information, and perhaps even better information than the scientists can get us by their tedious weighing and measuring and counting. So I think that Cayce was coming at this by a totally different method from the scientists, but he was coming at it and producing valid and vitally important information.
What do you think about Göbekli Tepe?
Göbekli Tepe, in a way, is the smoking gun. You know, back there in the 90s, when Robert Bovall and I and John Anthony West and Robert Schock were all saying that we think Giza is older, or at least that some aspects of Giza are older. We don't deny that the ancient Egyptians were heavily involved in the incarnation of Giza that we see still standing today, but we believe there is that was a legacy, that there was a much earlier aspect to that story going back to 10,500 BC or earlier. I mean, Robert Schock and John Anthony West's work on the Great Sphinx, looking at the precipitation-induced weathering of the Great Sphinx, the fact that the erosion patterns on the Sphinx bear testament that this monument was exposed to thousands of years of heavy rainfall. And such rainfall never fell during the historical period, during the last 5,000 years. Therefore, the monument must be much older than that. When Robert Schock, who's a professor of geology at Boston University, as a matter of fact, and John Anthony West presented this information to Egyptology, the Egyptologist said, "You're talking nonsense. That's not possible, because no other culture existed in the world 12,000 or so years ago that was capable of building monuments on such a grand scale." It sounded like a very compelling argument. How could the Sphinx be there alone if no other culture had ever produced anything large, any large and majestic architecture 12,000 or more years ago? But now in Turkey, we have Göbekli Tepe. And Göbekli Tepe has been excavated and dated by a mainstream archaeologist. And I am not surprised, Klaus Schmidt of the German Archaeological Institute, and I am not surprised that mainstream archaeology is keeping deadly quiet about Göbekli Tepe, because the orthodox dating of Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 plus years old. And we are looking at a gigantic megalithic site with megaliths weighing 20 or so tons, perfectly laid out with incredible precision, and the oldest stuff is the best. And this is 12,000 years old for sure. That is 7,000 years older than the orthodox date given to the pyramids, 7,000 years older than the orthodox date given to any megalithic site anywhere in the world. And there it is, huge, enormous, perfectly formed, just standing there, coming out, apparently out of nowhere, with no background, no history, nothing lying behind it at all. And that's impossible, of course. Something on the scale of Göbekli Tepe could never have been built without a vast antecedent knowledge that went into it. There has to have been hundreds, thousands of years of experimentation and learning and development of skills in order to create something like Göbekli Tepe. And there it stands, 12,000 years old. The oldest material is the best. And 10,000 years ago, it was deliberately buried, like a time capsule, and it sat there for the last 10,000 years, unseen by man, until an accidental turn of the archaeologist's spade brought it to light again. And bringing it to light brought with it the firm, irrefutable evidence by established scientific methods, which no archaeologists dispute, that this astonishing site is 12,000 plus years old. They can't say any longer that there is no other ancient culture that was building on the scale of the Sphinx 12,000 years ago, because there is. It's called Göbekli Tepe. And this is like opening the door, just a crack, and looking through it into a whole new world of discovery about our past and what our past means. And the power that Egyptologists and archaeologists have had to ridicule the idea of lost civilizations is single-handedly destroyed by the discovery of Göbekli Tepe, and our ability now to pair that up with structures like the Great Sphinx at Giza, which all along we've suspected are vastly much older than the archaeologists ever accepted they were.
Wow. And it's interesting, looking for signs of past civilizations' hallmarks.
We'll be right back with more, with Graham Hancock, on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Graham Hancock.
I think it's interesting that a lot of English castles from the Middle Ages were wooden, and
yes,
they degraded, and also a lot of hinges.
Yes.
And it's interesting. So I guess a mainstream archaeologist not seeing that might think those never existed.
They might think those never existed, and they might, again and again, you know, monuments are built and rebuilt on the site of older monuments. And it's a mistake to think that the last surviving version of the monument is the true age of construction work there. It's often much, much older than that.
You'll be speaking at the Ancient Mysteries Conference at the ARE in early October. What will you be speaking about?
Well, I'm going to review all my work over the last 20 years in the lost civilization field. I've spent a great deal of time. I spent 6 years scuba diving all around the world because sea levels rose by 400 feet at the end of the last ice age, again around 12,000 years ago. A gigantic cataclysm shook the Earth at that time. We know now that a huge comet exploded over North America 12,000 plus years ago. I have been privileged and fortunate enough to have traveled and explored this mystery on every continent, and I'm going to present all the data that I have, the best data that I have, that supports the case that we are missing a huge forgotten episode in the human story, that we are indeed a species with amnesia, and the time comes now when we must recover our memory. We cannot remain in amnesia anymore. We need to know who we are and where we came from if we're ever going to be able to move forward into a more just and a more decent and a more loving world, because the world is in a mess right now, and part of the reason it's in a mess is we've lost our connection with our past.
And also, actually, Dr. Zahi Hawass is going to be there at the same time, so people will be seeing, you know, the orthodox view, and they'll be able to contrast it and look at the evidence you present.
Yeah, it should be some fireworks flying.
You have a fictional book out titled Entangled.
I do, yes. I'm 62 years old now, and in the last few years, I decided to exercise some other writing muscles and write some fiction in the genre of historical and fantasy adventure. And Entangled is a time travel novel which has two protagonists, both young women, one of them living 24,000 years ago in the past and the other living today in modern Los Angeles. And they're brought together because I argue that time is an illusion, that time is not a straight line, it's not an arrow that goes from past through present to future, but it's more like a series of interlocking spirals where different ages intersect with one another and come close to one another, more a quantum physics view of time. Hmm. They're brought together by supernatural forces to do battle with a demon who travels through time and who's seeking to pervert and destroy the true purpose of mankind. And the burden of defeating this demon and defeating the dark forces within ourselves falls upon these two young women, Rhea, 24,000 years ago, and Leonie today. So that's Entangled, and as a matter of fact, I've just finished another novel which will be published in April next year, and that is a novel based on the extraordinary events of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, the story of Cortez and Montezuma, a great untold story which I've fictionalized. What I've discovered is I've not said goodbye to nonfiction. I will one day do a sequel to my book Fingerprints of the Gods, because there is so much new evidence on the lost civilization scenario. But what I've discovered in writing novels is that it's possible to explore the most extraordinary ideas that way. When you're writing nonfiction, you're constantly erecting this architecture of defense against the establishment, who are going to come and attack everything that you say. So what I found over the years was that my writing got more and more defensive. My book Underworld, which looks at the issue of underwater ruins and the great floods at the end of the last ice age, you know, it's more than 800 pages long. It has 2,000 footnotes. Now, the reason for that is that I wanted to make sure that the academics couldn't twist and distort anything I'd said.
Well, it's been great talking to you today, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been good talking to you as well.
It's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose. To find out more, go to kimmyrose.com. That's KimmyRose.com. Well, hello.
Hello.
And what's today's Thought for the Day?
Today's Thought for the Day is reading 5369-2. Do not let those things which may not in the present be understood weary thy soul, But know that sometime, somewhere, you too will understand. Keep the faith. Don't let those things. And this is what we were talking about. And this is, you know, this is the thing for me that's so important is just staying present. Because when we start worrying about things, usually we're worrying about things ahead of us. It's because somewhere in our past, we've had an unraveling or we have this fear that we can't control things. But if you are present, you know, what you can, that right now is what is here and now. And I notice that with me, I will get so, so busy and then I won't sleep. And that, it doesn't allow me to be present. There's such a weariness, or I can get upset. I'll get upset and I'm like, wow, I just expelled all this energy. And by just being still, I have more energy. And faith.
Oh, yes. Wow. Even though there's things going on that can make you weary that, and you don't understand why, and you think, why are all these bad things happening today? You have to have faith and know that later you'll understand.
You know, it's funny because William Blake said, he said, if the doors of perception were cleaned, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite.
Wow.
Perfect. I love that. It's the truth.
That's amazing. Well, thanks for doing the Thought for the Day today.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to Graham Hancock for talking to us. Make sure to look up his books, The Sign and the Seal, Fingerprints of the Gods, Supernatural, and Entangled. Also, he'll be speaking at the Ancient Mysteries Conference at the ARE in Virginia Beach from October 4th to the 7th. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the Thought for the Day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.